I'm very pleased to welcome to Fremantle Shipping News, Leslie Green. Welcome, Leslie.
Thank you very much, Michael. It's lovely to be here.
Well, here we are in the west end of Fremantle, not terribly far from where the America's Cup was defended way back in the day.
I remember it well.
I'll bet you do. It was always very sad that we lost it, but that Dennis Connor was a pretty good sailor from memory.
He was better than a bit good.
And it was quite exciting times there in Fremantle and Perth, as I recall it. And who were you working for at that point?
When the Cup started, when the defence began, and a bit before that, I was working for Dennis Connor.
Well, that was a very interesting turn of events. Now, I imagine Dennis had seen you around the traps in Newport 3 or 4 years earlier.
He had, I think, but I'd certainly never met him. But he saw the results of the various media campaigns and, you know, the publicity and the way the team was going. And the reality was that before 83, no one had had their own embedded public relations person, media person, or anybody like that. And they got into a lot of trouble. The Australians got into a lot of trouble in Newport with the media. And it was Warren Jones that put together a very different team and essentially wanted people who were experts, if you like, in various areas, be they sailors, be they administrators, whatever their job was. He knew that they had to change a lot of things from the way they'd run the campaign before.
So Alan Bond takes Australia 2, designed by Ben Lexon with its famed winged keel, John Bertrand running the boat, to Newport in 83. We all know the famous final race victory, and recently on the Shipping News, Skip Lissaman took us through it. I felt like I was there all over again, not in my living room in Canberra, as a young academic as I was 40 years ago, watching the final race. But Alan had been there before, and Warren Jones, and so the whole exercise, by the sound of it, had become very professional by the time they got to 83.
Yeah, and really that was Warren who made that happen. And they knew what they'd done incorrectly, perhaps, things that they could do better. And so Warren set about doing that. And he was also very aware that they had a boat that was going to really put the wind up a whole lot of people.
Including Dennis Connor.
Including Dennis Connor, but more specifically, the New York Yacht Club.
Well, a number of our listeners will have been to Manhattan and have forgotten the street. It's about 52nd or so where the New York Yacht Club is. It was a race, wasn't it, that, to put it in sort of common parlance, rich men would go off to race, and there wasn't a lot of publicity about it. You'd read about the results, but it wasn't anything that sort of appeared constantly in the newspapers. It certainly didn't capture a whole nation's attention.
Well, it did in Europe and England, and for a very long time it was the English who challenged, and the Americans were always quite worried about the English because it was the English that they had sailed against initially in 1851 and lost their best trophy, from the Isle of Wight and the Royal Yacht Squadron. And so it was always the English, and in fact, even before we went to Newport this time, they'd already dismissed the Australians as being they're just bogans, basically. Not that that's an American word, but and they behaved on occasion pretty badly, even the earlier ones from Sydney, except for the helmsman, Sir James Hardy, of course, who was an absolute gentleman. But Alan Bond's group did some pretty silly things. And one of the things that Warren told me happened was that in a previous challenge, they'd been walking along their dock and they were accosted by a very well-known Australian journalist, Bruce Stannard, who became a big current affairs reporter. And Warren said, and, you know, we didn't, Alan and I didn't behave very well. We threw him off the dock. And I said, what, you told him to get off the dock? And he said, no, we actually threw him in the water.
Well,
and I said, you have to be kidding me. You couldn't do that. To do that to a reporter, I mean, you're cutting your own throat, really. And he said, yes, he said, I think we can do better.
So is that because they didn't like what he'd been writing, or they just didn't
like
journalists?
I think he was harassing them with questions,
at
which they didn't want to answer.
Oh, so they thought the better way was to Google
him. And one of the things that we did in Newport when I was managing the media and PR for them was we kept media, generally speaking, off the dock where the boat was. We had gates, we had guards, and because it was very distracting for a start, and also because we, you know, Warren had decided essentially that Alan should not be anywhere near the media, generally speaking, because he used to get cross. And he did make one appearance, and he did do some short interviews then, and that was when we became the challenger, and we opened up the dock, and the media just surged in, and I was supposed to be controlling them.
Good
luck. And I have a photograph, which I can show you, of me on this dock trying to hold the world's media back with my elbows.
You didn't finish up in the water like Bruce Stannard.
No, I didn't. it worked well. Alan was able to get on with his role, which was essentially as the syndicate head. And he was, he was wheeling and dealing. He was looking after business interests, which is what a lot of the syndicate heads did. That's why they came to Newport in the first place, because it was a perfect place to do business.
And the banks in New York went that far away, and it was a very good branding exercise.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Let's talk, though, about how this young woman in 1983 found herself mixed up with this particular tilt at the America's Cup, the Australia 2, the Ellen Bond. What had been your background, Leslie, that brought you to that point?
Well, I was a journalist, essentially, and always had been a journalist.
Here in the West.
Here in the West, at the good old Daily News.
Good old Daily News.
And the afternoon paper that we used to have.
Paul Rigby on the back with his cartoons.
Paul Rigby, actually, I have to tell you, when I lived in Newport with my other female colleague, Alison Baker, we were in this very old house, old sort of Dutch colonial house in Newport, and it had an attic up the above. And in the owners had transferred the attic and transformed it into a unit. And the Rigby family was living there during the America's Cup summer. Not so much Paul and his wife. They were in New York because he was still working for the Newport Daily News. And but they would come down on weekends and things. But their kids were up there. And their kids were teenage. And they loved a party. And they were right above Alison and my bedrooms. And one night, Alison woke up to feel drips on her head, water coming through the ceiling. And we finally worked out was that it was the kids upstairs fooling around with the bath, and they'd obviously filled up the bath with water and hadn't turned the taps off properly. And poor old Alison, really, nearly got drowned.
Now, there were all of the challenger races, so that Australia 2 had to beat everybody else to qualify to go against Liberty. And she eventually succeeded in doing that. And the crew must have been pretty upbeat. But through that whole period leading up to the final seven races, what was your job?
My job was to, when I first got to Newport, because obviously I hadn't been involved in an America's Cup before, so I had to learn all about the media side of that. We were very close to the media centre and also the media tent, which was put up by Louis Vuitton, and people could watch television in there,
or the media
could. And they... So I needed to know, all right, who were the yachting reporters? Were there any Australians in Newport when I got there? And the answer was basically no, because I got there early. The Americans, were they sort of linked to the American side? Would they be against whatever we were doing to start with? What was their opinion of the Australians? And how could we make a difference? You know, how could we change that opinion if it wasn't good? Where would we focus our attempts? And we decided to focus our attempts on Australia and Australians, because that's where our support was. So if there were any, or as soon as any, you know, Australian media turned up at the dock office wanting to interview someone, we would try and look after them, because we knew that it was harder for them than the Americans, who were more experienced, and also that we needed really good publicity coming out of Australia. And then we had to work out what we were going to do about some of the American reporters who were trying to, obviously they're the ones that were trying to find out about the keel before anyone else. They were trying to, of course they were. And in fact, we got a little worried about it at one stage in the office, which was an old shed on a boat dock. It wasn't secure. And Warren called in some people to check for bugs, because we thought it was possible that that might happen. There weren't any. But we had to be really, really careful. And when either Alison or I left the office, or when we were both out of the office for some reason, or we left at night, the thing that was the most precious thing that we had in that office were Ben Lexon's plans.
Oh, you had them?
Oh, yes.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes. Well, they had to be available, because Ben sort of shared our office to a degree. You know, he'd come in and do some drawings and then wander off again. He also wasn't allowed to talk to the media, because he would react in interesting ways. But he would pop in, you know, and draw some things and wander off. And so when we left the office, what we would do is, Alison had a big pink basket, and a straw, sort of like a straw basket, that's sealed up at the top, and we would put Ben's plans into the basket, and we would take it with us everywhere we went. If we were both out of the office, where there was a safe, once we left the office there wasn't, and we would go down to maybe Christie's bar to have a drink after work, and we would sit around with, you know, our mates and people we knew, and have a couple of Planters Punch drinks. Planters Punch was the drink at the time, with rum and who knows what else, pineapple juice, I think.
And rum.
And more rum.
And rum. Did you ever leave that blessed basket behind?
Yes.
Oh, no.
Oh, no, not behind. Basically, what happened was, if Alison got up to go to the bar and get a drink or talk to someone...
You can't blame Alison for all of this.
No, but she would sort of push the basket near to me.
Yes.
You know, she'd say, oh, I'm just going up to get a drink, you know, and she'd say, oh, I don't want my purse to be stolen, yep, or, you know, whatever. And so I'd say, okay, fine, that's fine. Anyway, one night she was absent for quite some time, and then she came back, and then she said, where's my basket? And I said, well, didn't you put it down here somewhere? And she said, yes, I did. And she said, it's not here. And she said, I've looked there and I've looked there and it's nowhere. I can't find it. We just absolutely almost had heart attacks. But we, you know, she didn't know what to say because all these people around us were saying, well, what, you know, what are you so worried about? And she said, oh, well, my purse was in there. And someone said, you're holding your purse in your hand. Anyway, we scrambled around everywhere. And then I suddenly had a thought and I looked under the chair. And the basket somehow had been moved, pushed or whatever, and it was under the chair. Oh, my God.
Imagine if when she was asked, she hadn't said my purse was in it. But, oh, Bing Lexon's plans are in. Probably all the international yachting journalists of the world would have descended upon you and helped you look for
it. Yeah, because no one ever thought to look in Alice's basket for Ben Lexon's plans.
Come back to the job you and Alison had, running the media here.
Alison was the office manager.
She was managing the office.
Yes.
You're managing the media, generally speaking. And it sounds from what you've said, there's two aspects to this. One is organising an entree for journalists and others who want to talk to the Australian crew from the top down. And the other is you trying to ensure that good news stories get out, not just in Australia, but I imagine through the US, UK, Europe, all of the countries where the challenging boats came from. Would that be a fair description of what you had to do?
Yes, I was also chief party organiser.
Now we're getting serious.
No, well, we perhaps can get to that, but it was a job that involved the whole sort of managing the whole sort of media scene and also building brand and reputation, which was pretty bad at the time. And we gradually saw that happening. But the reality was that, you know, back in 83, I think people forget how few communications tools we had at our disposal.
So tell us what you did have.
Well, in our little, you know, funny little office, Alison and I both had an electric typewriter each.
A golf ball.
Yes, and lots of paper and, you know, copied, what's that blue paper that goes in the middle?
Carbon paper.
Carbon paper.
Did you really?
Yeah, we had carbon paper, you know, for our copies. And we had a telex machine that it seemed only Alison knew how to work. We had desk phones. You remember those? Remember desk phones?
I do.
And so they were basically on the desk and connected to the wall. And there were three phones for basically four people. And God, I think that was just about it.
So you'd have to pick the phone up to telephone somebody. The phone would ring and you would answer it. Mm. Telexes were always a strange thing, but if you had to communicate with Perth or Sydney or somewhere, you'd probably be sending a telex.
Yes.
I'm assuming Alan might pop in and send a telex to his bank manager or something like that.
Well, he would pop in and speak to Alison because Alison handled all that sort of Bond Corporation and Alan Bond's private company work.
Yes.
And she had done for years. So all the sort of business side of anything was done at Alison's desk. And I used to, she would get the calls in the office and switch through to me if it was a call for me. And I'd take the call. But it was an incredibly noisy office because it was on a dock and there were boats and ships and, you know, small ships and all sorts of people and vessels in the harbour. And so there were ship's horns and hoots and toots and people yelling off the dock, you know, and people running up and down this rickety old dock and making a noise. The noise was just horrendous. So you were trying to talk on the phone to Australia or somewhere, because during the day, of course, Australia was asleep.
Yes.
So if we wanted to talk to the reporters in Perth, ended up being in the office every day for 12 to 14 hours.
Remind people that from that east coast of the US, it's a 12-hour difference.
A 12-hour difference,
middle of the
exactly.
day here is middle of the night. there.
Yeah, mm-hmm. We often were talking to people in the middle of the night. But, you know, that's what you did because it was the only thing you way to do it that you knew how to do.
Did you learn a lot, I'm assuming you did, about the way the US media you were dealing with who were interested in the America's Cup Challenge, how they operated?
Yes, the media was very mixed. It was mainly East Coast because Middle America and the rest of America didn't give a damn, honestly, about America's Cups. This was a rich man's sport to them and something they had no interest in. But the East Coast journalists, very often from New York, so they were pretty sort of powerful people in their own right. And so they were sort of moving in after a while. Then you had the yachting writers who were more interested in the sailing side of things. Mm. And also in the boat, in our very unusual boat. And then you had the local reporters from the local papers, and their main concern was that if anyone else won the America's Cup, they would lose trade. You know, they'd be closing their shops.
Yes.
People would want to move out.
Mm.
I mean, it was an economic thing,
yeah.
Because every 3 years or so, you know, the world would move into Newport and spend an awful lot of money.
Yes.
And that would keep them going for the next 3 years.
Well, many of us have always wondered if we'd retain the cup here in Fremantle and kept retaining it, just how that phenomenon would work. I went to Newport before all of that happened in 83, and it was a quiet day I was there, but I've been envisaging recently just how crazy it must have been for people like you there. So you're working later into the night. Was there a typical time of the day you would start? Were there rules about when the media could bother you?
If there had been, they would have ignored them. Usually we started at 8 o'clock in the morning. We would walk down from our house in Division Street and we would go to the post office, which opened quite early, to collect any mail that had come in. And a lot of mail was coming in, interestingly, from school kids in Australia, because they set up a program here, apparently, in the schools, where kids were asked to draw a picture of the boat and send a message to the team. And this was fabulous for us, because we really felt that support from home when you got a whole lot of drawings from kids at...
makes it very real, doesn't it?
Yeah, Kenwick Primary School or Applecross High or wherever it was.
Yeah.
And that was, in a way, more lovely and wonderful to us than getting a letter from the Aga Khan or, telex from the Queen or something. It showed that there was such tremendous grassroots support going on in Australia for us.
Listeners will be wanting me to ask immediately, was there something from the Aga Khan and something from the Queen?
Oh, yes. I think I've got the telex at home somewhere. the message that came in from the Aga Khan at the end, you know, when we actually won the cup. And certainly, I think John Longley had it, the telex that came from Buckingham Palace.
That's
the
amazing.
English... yeah.
The school kids' letters, was that Australia-wide or did it have a particularly a sort of a Perth, West Australia focus?
I think it was a lot of Perth, but I can't remember exactly. And I mean, we had many, many of these drawings. They seemed to come from everywhere. There was also, I think, Telstra at the time had a competition or set up a thing where people could send us this is towards the end, could send us telexes and messages of support. And they started rolling in at such a rate towards the end that we started pinning them up on the back wall all around the office, and they were everywhere. And then we had kids' drawings on top of that, and then we had cards and letters on top of that. And it looked like, you know, Christmas. It also disguised the terribly horrible walls and the everything else. But we really felt that support. And, of course, Americans could see it when they came to our office. You know, the whole nation appeared to be supporting us. And nothing like that, of course, ever happened on the other side. That was much more of a business-like defence of the cup.
Well, they didn't expect to lose it.
They didn't expect to lose it, and they just had a different mindset.
Yes.
Someone eventually, as the whole media scene began to change, and the media was very much coming across to our side, they really wanted us to win, because they kept saying, oh, we want to go to Australia for the next America's Cup.
Was there a point, Les, at which it went from being just another sailing race where there were reputational interests and business interests, and Alan Bond had particular interests there, but then again, Warren Jones wanted to make sure that professionally, with the sorts of sailors he had with great experience, that all worked well, where you realised this was bigger than either of those things. This had become some sort of national endeavour, and suddenly you click your fingers and say, wow, when did that happen?
Ah, well, we knew nothing about really what was happening in Australia. We only knew what was in front of our noses in Newport, and of course the American media never commented on any of that.
No.
So the first time, I think, that anyone knew anything was after the cup was won. We were certainly getting a tremendous amount of messages in the office, and, you know, through the media in a way, but we had no idea whatsoever of what was happening in Australia. None at all. You know, people would call on the phone, but I mean, we had three phones. I mean, you couldn't be on the phone. And after the cup as well, we weren't really answering the phone because we had other things to do. We had to get the office packed up. The guys had to get the boat packed up. We had to go and get the America's Cup because, you know, we weren't going to leave without it. And so we, and a lot of people had made travel plans for after the cup. Oh, you know, we're going to go up to New York for a couple of weeks, and, you know, and that's what I had done. And other people were going off to see relatives or friends or something, or going across to Europe.
Well, we have to remind our younger listeners, in fact, they can be fairly old and still be younger listeners for the purpose of this comment, that in those days there wasn't an email. It was still a good...
Oh, there was nothing. There was no
internet
email,
was
no
still
text.
10 years away, more or less. Yeah. It was just crazy. You didn't have a CNN broadcasting this constantly, which everyone was tuned into.
No, I mean, there was television broadcast of the racing. You could go and watch, you know, a broadcast in a tent on the foreshore.
And as we did in Australia.
Yeah, but in our office, no, we didn't have a television.
An unnecessary expense, Leslie.
Well, I don't know why. I mean, we could hardly move. There was so much stuff in there. But we had the, you know, the phone, the desk phone, and that was how we had to speak to the rest of the world.
Were there some...
But the, you said, when did people first know about this?
We don't really.
It was interesting talking to some of the guys recently, and Rob Brown was one of them. He lives in Queensland, and he's one of the crew. And he's coming over for the cup.
Oh, wonderful.
But he was saying that they arrived back with the first group on a plane. How they got that plane was another interesting story, which I'll tell you in a minute. But Rob said, you know, they landed at Sydney Airport out of New York, basically, and they saw this enormous crowd at Sydney Airport all waiting, you know, for this plane to land. And they thought, oh God, we must have a celebrity on board. Yeah, we must have someone famous. Who is it? You know, and they're looking around, they can't see anyone. And then they got to the step and the, you know, the doors opened and a few of the guys sort of stepped out, and this cheer, roaring cheer went up from the, from the crowd. And they thought,
isn't it?
Oh, they're here for us. You know, us, you know, a couple of young sailors.
Bogans from,
you know,
Australia.
Yeah, exactly. They just couldn't fathom it at all. And it was like that for everyone.
And what about for you? Let's jump forward or back, right back in the middle of it. the last race, which Skipper's described for us all so beautifully, is won. And he sort of intimated, I think they were all in bed by 8 or 9 o'clock, they were so exhausted, had a couple of beers and that was that. But what about for you? I imagine from a media perspective and what you had to look after, a lot of your work was just starting when that win was registered.
Not really. No, it didn't really work like that. I mean, it was chaos on the night.
Yes.
There were two times where I thought I was actually going to die.
Oh.
The first time was I was on a big media boat out at sea and at the winning moment. And I knew that I had to get back to the dock very quickly. I went to the captain of this particular vessel and asked him to phone through to the Black Swan and get me a chase boat driver and a chase boat to get me back to the dock, because there were thousands of ships and boats and vessels on the water. The waves were sky high.
Planes in the air,
there
and helicopters.
There were 30-something helicopters in the sky. There was the big blimp as well. The noise was unbelievable. People yelling and screaming. And a lot of people trying to, you know, surge towards Australia too. Girls in bikinis, you know, waving.
Oh, naturally.
You know, furiously. All girls love a sailor, as you know.
Wish I were a sailor.
And so one of the guys came over and got me into the boat, and I had to hang on to this sort of railing, and then he just took off at a million miles an hour.
This is in the chase boat.
In the chase boat, and it was like up and down and up, and you know, I was...
You thought you were going to
die.
Oh
my God, I honestly thought I wouldn't make it. And we got back to the dock, and fortunately that was okay, and then we had to wait for everybody to come in. And then again, it was just madness and chaos on that dock. Absolutely crazy. People climbing up telegraph poles and, you know, aerials or whatever, and trying to get a good shot of this, and people diving under the water to see if they could see the keel after the boat docked. And it was just unbelievable.
So you get there, you get off the boat,
yes,
the chase boat, you're still in one piece, you're not sure. What did you do?
Well, we had to wait for our boat to come in to start with, and of course that was the moment when Alan Bond, after a little while, decided to raise the boat, raise the vessel up, and show everybody the keel. Well, of course everybody went even crazier then, but then some poor soul got through from the media centre and said, you've got to get the team down to the media centre, we've got to have the press conference. Because that's what they do, a post-win press conference. So
that's coming from the yacht club, the officials wanting to have the media conference.
No, it's just what they do.
Right.
You know, they get both teams to come down to the media centre and sit there and be interviewed by all the press, you know, without all the public.
Post-match discussion.
Yes. But on this occasion, you know, I didn't even know how we were going to get there, because the streets were jam-packed and we had a fair walk to get up to the media centre. So actually Alan Bond came up with a good idea. He suggested we all form a crocodile. So you grabbed hold of a person in front of you around the waist. With your arm, you locked your arms, you know, around them. The person behind you locked their arms around you. And then we just tried to surge through this middle of this crowd. Well, of course, that pulled them in closer. And at one stage, I could feel my ribs, you know, actually crushing.
This is the second time you thought you were going to die.
Yeah, that night. I thought, well, we're not going to make it.
Wow.
Anyway, Alan managed to, you know, get through. What we didn't know at the time was that on the way, Eileen's very, very expensive watch got ripped off her wrist, which she didn't notice at the time because it was just madness.
Oh. You mean there was like a pickpocket in the crowd and took the opportunity?
Yeah. Anyway, we eventually you know.
Was Eileen in that conga or that crocodile as well?
Yes, they were up the front.
So how long was this
well,
crocodile?
Well, 36 or 37 people long.
All holding on tight. Mm. Wow.
So I get up, I'm further down the line because I was pushing people on earlier, and I get to the front door, and Alan and all the main mob are inside, and the police outside the door. And this policeman just stopped me, he just sort of pushed me.
You're a woman.
Well, he said, you know, you're not the team, you're not team. And I said, yes, I am. I had all the clothes on and everything. And then I showed him my media pass, you know, which I had. And he said, no, stand over there, stand there. And he literally pinned me to the wall and I couldn't move. And I thought, oh, this is ridiculous. Anyway, there was a little melee going on in the crowd, which suddenly diverted him. And he took off to arrest someone. And I just shot through the door and I got myself in there.
Well done, Leslie.
Thank you.
So you get into the place.
I got in there.
Is it like I imagine a lot of these things are? It's actually not a big area, or is it?
Oh, it was a reasonable size area. It was part of an old military installation from about the 1700s that was turned into the media centre. And there was a stage in the front where everyone could sit that was being interviewed. And they had a moderator, a guy who was supposed to, you know, control the questions and things.
Good luck.
And, and then a lot of our guys were on the stage and almost falling off the stage. And then the media, because you could have a desk if you wanted to in the media centre. So there were desks, lines of desks, and, you know, journalists sitting behind them and typing away on their...
Someone was given the nod to ask a question, that sort of thing?
Yeah, the moderator, he knew all the media. But on this night, it didn't really
free
work that
all.
Way. He just basically handed over to Alan Bond.
I imagine part of your role...
Let me tell you about the watch, though.
Oh, no, the watch.
The watch.
Is this a happy ending?
Well, Eileen discovered that this very, very expensive watch was missing. And she reported it. And
not to the same policeman who was outside.
No. And they said, oh, gosh, you know, it was so crowded. I mean, we probably haven't got any chance of finding it. And so she put in an insurance claim and the company was very good. You know, they sorted that out. And then months and months later, could have been a year, could have been 2 years later, she got a phone call from the police in Newport who told her that they had been digging in someone's garden looking for contraband.
Digging in someone's garden?
Yes.
Looking for contraband?
Yes, there was somebody living there that they were wanted to...
Keeping their eye on.
Yeah, arrest for something. And one of the things they found was her watch. But the guy they were digging, whose garden they were digging up, was a policeman.
Well,
so
there's a novel. There's a novel in this.
So she actually got it back.
She got
it back.
Two watches. Yes.
Yeah.
Leslie, we're all familiar with politicians who have their minders, and if you're a politician here today, we were going to be talking about something. They would ask me exactly what I was going to talk about, and they will have been primed by their minder, their PR type advisor, mm-hmm. about what they should and shouldn't say and staying on message and all of those things. Did you have any sort of role when it came to the crew and others, when even Alan, if he was going to stand in front of a camera and a microphone in his hand, as to what they should and shouldn't be saying?
Yes. We did a lot of that sort of thing. It was very hard to convince Alan what he was...
He knew what he had to say.
He was going to say whatever he was going to say. But he was aware that he was looking after the interests of the syndicate, obviously, and taking instructions on what he couldn't do from Warren, so that he could just get on with what he wanted to do. But the same thing with Warren. You know, when somebody would call up wanting an interview or something, and I knew that they were very much in the opposition camp, that they and had been so for a long time, including not just journalists but also photographers. And I would say to Warren, you know, I don't know that there's any value for us in talking to this particular person, because I think they're too entrenched in the other camp. So we would have those conversations at all times. And if something happened, you know, I would have a grasp on what effect that was likely to have on us, like our brand, our reputation, our this or that, and whether or not we should comment on it or we shouldn't.
You want to avoid negative publicity, you want to make sure reputation
damage is not. We were going to get it anyway from some of the American side, but I thought it was important that we often didn't comment on things. And the Newport Daily News in the early stages often used to comment on things like people would say that they'd seen the keel. They knew exactly what it looked like. And so someone would draw up a sketch of the alleged keel, and the next day there it would be in the paper. So there were many of these, and none of them were ever right. And as John Longley said to me recently, as far as we can tell, no one ever did see the keel until that curtain was raised. A lot of people pretended to or tried to, but they didn't actually get to it. So these pictures would come all the time, and then we'd be asked for comment. You know, is that the keel? And we would just not make any official comment whatsoever. And we just let it go on.
Kept them guessing.
Yeah.
It's a great technique.
And then Ben Lexon had an idea. And you always worried when Ben had an idea. But he came into our office one day. All the guys were out sailing. It was just Alison and I in the office. And Ben came in, went to his drawing board, humming away to himself and scribbling away on one of his, you know, pieces of plan paper. And we said, "What are you doing?" And he said, "Oh, just drawing something on the boat, you know." And then he went out of the office with a roll of plan under his arm. Was gone for 5 or 10 minutes and came back, rubbing his hands together.
Without the thing under his arm.
No, he didn't have anything under his arm. And we said, "Ben, what have you been doing? You know, what are you doing?" He said, "I drew a plan of the yacht, and you know, with a winged keel." They knew it was winged, with a winged keel.
Where did he drop it?
And we said, "Yeah." And he said, "And then I took it round to Newport Offshore, which was the company that controlled the docks, where they had a big photocopier." And he said, "And I copied a whole bunch of stuff." And he said, "And then I copied this plan." And then he said, "You know, everyone knows I'm forgetful.
And I left one of them behind."
And he said, "I left one of them under the cover." And I said, "That is going to be in the Newport Daily News tomorrow."
Brilliant.
And he said, "Well, we'll see." Anyway, Warren and I think John Longley was with him, came back from sailing. And I explained to Warren what Ben had done. Ben had gone missing by then. And Warren said, "Oh my God." I said, "No, I think this will be all right." You know? So Warren said, "John, because I'd already been down to Newport Offshore just to photocopy something ordinary, but just to check whether someone had thought, oh, it's a bit of rubbish, and they'd put it in the bin."
Yes.
But there was nothing in the bin when I was there. So I came back, and then Warren said to John, "Go down to Newport Offshore and ask them for all the rubbish that's come out of the bin this afternoon." So John went down there and said, "Yes, look, could we possibly collect
the rubbish
from the bin? because we think someone has possibly left something in the photocopier that would be very embarrassing if it were found.
Grist for the mill.
Yeah. So what happened then was they gave him this huge bag of rubbish when we knew there'd be nothing in there that
and
we
there
were
wasn't.
Interested in. No.
What a great...
Nothing there. And so next day, guess what?
It was
in the Newport
Daily
News.
Daily News.
They'd actually adapted it from the plan to an illustration, you know, so...
So it didn't look like...
And so it didn't look like they had the plans.
It was Ben's name on it,
yeah. Yeah, and across the top was a big banner saying, Australia 2.
Well, I can imagine the Fremantle Shipping News trying to get a scoop like that. Now tell me, were there some particular memories that you had, crisis, near death, you've given us those, from this period of your life? It must have been quite exciting.
Look, I think there were probably so many. There were many, many highlights. And really, not many lowlights. You know, I can't think of anything really terrible that happened or whatever. But I think most of the highlights came almost when we got home.
Let's come to coming home in a moment. Before we leave Newport, I'm somehow guessing that it wasn't all late night phone calls back to Australia and getting there at 8 o'clock in the morning. I know they probably didn't have anything approaching a flat white. We probably didn't much hear in those days.
No.
Going out and getting something to eat and drink and turning up to the bar and nearly losing things and all of that. But there must have been a hell of a social life going on.
There was, because Newport
and
was...
You said you were the party organiser.
Yes. Well, I went to several because our guys were pretty much incarcerated in the crew house when they weren't sailing. They weren't generally, I mean, they got out a little bit occasionally, but generally speaking, they were very much focused on the job they had to do. And so Alison and I often used to get to go to a lot of different parties, and there was one certainly that stays in my memory. As we know, in Newport, there are a lot of amazingly beautiful, magnificent mansions built around about between the 1700s and 1900s by very wealthy people, generally from New York or even from Europe. Many different styles of home. And we were invited one time to a party at a place called, at a property called Hammersmith Farm. And we were told we were going to have a New England clam bake, which is...
the famous clam bake.
Yes, which is, an outdoor function, essentially, on this beautiful property overlooking the harbour in Newport. And the clam bake is where they cook seafood in a sort of a pit oven that they've dug in the ground. And... they steam and cook the seafood, including clams, lobsters, oysters, all that sort of thing, in these pit ovens and with some vegetables as well, and serve that. And it was absolutely magnificent. But the thing that I think really made this night really stick in my head was the fact that it was Hammersmith Farm. And Hammersmith Farm was the childhood home of a woman by the name of Jackie, or Jacqueline. Now, Jacqueline grew up and married in Newport. And she married a very good-looking local lad called...
Just up the road?
Just up the road at Martha's Vineyard, I think, named John Fitzgerald Kennedy. And of course he a few years later became the President of the United States, and Jackie became the First Lady.
And you were in her childhood home, having the clam bake.
In her childhood home, having a clam bake. It was still owned by her sister, who was a European princess of some sort, following her marriage. And so it was still in Kennedy, well, you know, the name wasn't Kennedy then. Yes. It was a very long German name. But it was a magical night because you were there doing exactly what John Kennedy and Jackie Kennedy used to do, having a beautiful meal with their international friends, their sailing friends. You know, there are photographs of John and Jackie watching an America's Cup back in the day.
Wow. And there you were.
And yeah, I mean, you really felt part of history.
You come back to Australia. You've told us about the lads getting off the plane looking for the international rock star and realising it's them. And suddenly everything changes. Bob Hawke famously said, any Bobs who sacks anyone today?
Well, let me tell you about Bob Hawke in the Royal Perth Yacht Club, because on the night we won in Newport, we went to, after all this melee at the media centre, we went back to Alan's house. And there were all sorts of people there. The crew was there, various guests, special guests, including a former head of the Reserve Bank of Australia. This is in Newport.
Yes.
And all sorts of amazing people. I can't remember whether Rupert Murdoch was there or not, but he was certainly came out to watch races with us. So it was, you know, there were a lot of people there. A lot of, you know,
pandemonium,
very happy people.
Yes.
And I got called into this room where Alan was sitting with a lot of these former government people. And he said to me, Leslie, I want you to ring the Prime Minister.
Right.
I said, okay. Yeah, I think what he actually said was, will you get Bob Hawke on the phone for me?
And you did?
So one of the government people handed me a phone number. Yeah, because, I mean, I wouldn't have known how to contact the Prime Minister. And he said, look, ring this number and explain, you know, who wants to talk to him, etc. So I got the old dial-up phone, you know, and rang this number, spoke to somebody there, explained what it was. And she said, I'll get someone to ring you back. Then a man came on the phone a little bit later on, and he said he was one of the people who looked after the Prime Minister. What did you want? I explained to him. And he said, well, he said, he's not here at the moment, because this was a Canberra number. And I said, where is he? And he said, well, he's actually in Perth at Royal Perth Yacht Club
celebrating
the win. And he said, but if you give us a little moment or two, he said, we'll come back to you. You know, I'll get a message to him and, you know, he might ring. So we waited about 5 minutes. Next thing, phone rings. And this same guy's on the phone again. And he said, the Prime Minister would like to speak to Alan Bond. So I said, Alan, here's a phone.
I thought you were going to say, this voice came out and said, ah, g'day, Leslie. Is Alan there?
Well, he probably said that to Alan.
Yes.
So Alan took the call, but what Alan wanted was for the Prime Minister to get in touch with Qantas and tell them to send a plane over to bring the guys back.
And that effectively happened.
If that effectively happened.
You get back, literally the rest of Australia out of it. We're having big parties here quite soon in September on the 40th anniversary of the Australia 2 victory over Liberty. But there were all sorts of huge civic celebrations. Frio, Langley Park. Tell us about what happened.
We've gathered first on the main Australia 2 day, which I think was October the 30th, 1983. And we gathered on a stage here in Fremantle in front of the town hall. And there was a, you know, sort of a celebration there. Speeches were made and things, and we were presented with gifts. And this was particularly poignant for some of the people who live in Fremantle and around Fremantle, or who did. For example, Alan Bond and Eileen Bond were Fremantle people.
Yes.
And so was Warren Jones. Alan and Warren had gone to the same school in Fremantle back in the day. So that was pretty emotional for them in particular, because the streets around, I mean, you couldn't see beyond all of the people. You couldn't see a road because it was just filled with people. And Eileen Bond told me recently, she said, we thought that all the people had come here, you know, and we were amazed, but we weren't confident that anyone was going to turn up on Langley Park just to look at us. So from Fremantle, we got into a whole series of cars, open-top cars, that the MG Car Club provided for us, and took off down, you know, slowly, down Stirling Highway into Subiaco. We thought there would be no one on Stirling Highway. We'd get there in, you know, record time. But honestly, we were totally stunned by the literally tens of thousands of people that lined the whole route along Stirling Highway, up through Nedlands, into Subiaco, down into the city, and then into the park.
Princess Di would have been envious.
Well, exactly. And at one stage, the cars kept overheating. You know, they're all vintage MGs. And so we stopped at one point in Nedlands, it was, for a few minutes, because somebody up the front had a problem. And the crowd sort of started getting a little bit closer to the cars at the time. And the people were calling out, congratulations, you know, well done, whatever. But some of them, you could tell, were a little bit confused as to why there were two women in the middle of what they assumed were all crew.
You and Alison.
It was Alison and I, yes. And, you know, what were they doing there? Anyway, one woman yelled out from the crowd, I think to me, but it might have been to Alison, and she said, what were you, the cook? Back in 83, the women just weren't involved in men's sporting teams, whether it be, you know, football or anything really, except if they were the secretary. That was acceptable. So people just didn't relate to that.
Couldn't get it.
No, and that wasn't the last time, because later on, when we were invited to go to Canberra and have lunch with the Prime Minister, you know, Bob and Alan had become very good mates by then, we went over to the lodge. That's where the function was held.
You're not going to tell me that Newport policeman was there.
No. But again, when we arrived and everything, and then we sat down at these tables for a beautiful lunch, the seating plan, you know, that they had everybody correct except me. And I was with my husband of the time, because we were all able to take our partners. And I was on the list. Oh, sorry, my husband was on the list as Mr. David Green, support, they used to call us support crew. And I was Mrs. D. Green.
This is 83, 84.
Yeah, and it's at the Prime Minister's lodge. Anyway, we decided one of the wives who shall remain nameless.
But good on her.
But she has a connection in the Fremantle area. We found ourselves in the ladies' room at the lodge. And we saw this magnificent, as you would have in such a place, these beautiful white linen hand towels on the bench. And they had the Prime Minister's insignia on them, you know, embroidered on these beautiful white hand towels. It was a pile of them. And we had a sort of thought that wouldn't it be lovely, you know, to have that in your bathroom? And then we thought, there's no paper towels or anything. So I think these are meant for souvenirs.
Like you're thinking.
Yeah, and it must be. You know, otherwise they would have just given us paper towels, wouldn't they? And she said, yes, I think that's probably right. And so I said, okay, well, I think I'll liberate one and you liberate the other one, another one. So we felt terribly guilty, but we walked out with our paper towels tucked away in our handbags. And I've still got that I've still got that linen towel today.
Leslie Green, it's been lovely talking to you. And let's hope in just a little way we've righted the gender balance in the winning of the America's Cup 40 years ago. Thank you so much.
Thank you.